I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae on News Talk.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
We're going to talk about the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. And we have Dr. Shane Bergen, physicist at UCD, and Dr. Laura Dungan, medic and immunologist, joining us. Laura, our first story has to do with lungs.
It does, actually. And I just think this is truly fascinating. A good few years ago now, I was an intern and I used to work on the cystic fibrosis team. And I watched a lot of people with cystic fibrosis get very sick, and some of them end up in ICU, and sadly even a couple of them die from a lack of lung transplant. So this is something that when I read this story, I was really kind of moved by, and I think it's really amazing. It's the story that's come out of Chicago, Northwestern University, where a surgeon there who's a cardiothoracic surgeon has kept a man, a 33-year-old man, alive for 48 hours without his lungs, which someone would think is kind of necessary for life. So effectively what happened is this poor man got very sick. He got acute respiratory distress syndrome. His lungs weren't working. They were very badly infected. He was effectively dying. And in order to save him, they removed his lungs and kept him alive on this external artificial lung system.
So hang on, before we talk about that, just very quickly, removing lungs, is that a fairly straightforward thing? Like, you know, when you look at anatomy books, like biology books, and everything is so distinct, but actually when you speak to a doctor, they say, yeah, it's all kind of mashed up. Or if you ever speak to a doctor and they say, can you see that thing there? That's the whatever it is, the gallbladder. It's never as distinct as it is in the cartoony, biology book. So is it easy enough to take the lungs out? Are they separate floppy doppy things?
It's absolutely not. Right. Now, look, I suppose if you are a surgeon whose job it is to remove and replace lungs, then you are able to see what the differences are. But I do remember when I was a student going in and looking at surgery and thinking it would look like the cartoon or the perfect diagram. And it's a mess, a big old mashy mess. Now, I'd say the abdomen is worse than the thorax, so the lungs are slightly less of a mess. You can see them getting big and small and big and small when you're breathing, but it's not easy. Now, it's harder to put them back in than it is to take them out, but they also put them back into this man. So they took out the very heavily infected lungs. They used this machine, and not only did it exchange the carbon dioxide for the oxygen, it also kept the blood pumping through the heart, which is key because it meant that he didn't get clots. And he basically started to massively improve in the next day or two. His kidneys, which had been near failure, came back to almost normality, and they were able to put in the new lungs that they had waiting for him within 48 hours. And this man is alive 3 years later, having been effectively on death's door. I think it's such an amazing and fascinating, it's not a long-term therapy. We're not going to live without our lungs and be wandering around. But this bridge to try and get people to improve before you put the lungs in is phenomenally exciting.
So the lungs were causing the problem because they were infected. Because the lack of oxygen meant everything was stressed, and actually transplanting the lungs then meant less likely that things are going to go well. So he was put on what, like, two tubes stuck into where his lungs should be? Or what do they do with the artificial lung? How did that work?
Yeah, effectively, what you're saying is accurate. So if they had put the new lungs in straight away, like they would with the traditional transplant, his body was in such bad shape that he wasn't going to survive, or you could be pretty sure he wasn't going to survive. So by taking out the lungs and letting all his organs calm down and repair and relax, even if it was only for 48 hours, they were able to ensure that when they put the new lungs in, that this man survives. And it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a bypass procedure. So the blood comes all the way out of the body. Then this external lung acts as a lung. And you know, the job of the lung is to effectively remove the carbon dioxide and add back in the oxygen. And then the blood is pumped back in the body, but still through the heart. It's not a heart bypass like you see sometimes in cardiac surgery. People have heard of bypass surgery. Now, obviously, bypass can also mean when you're grafting in an artery or a vein, but when you're bypassing the heart, it means you leave the heart out altogether. But in this system, the blood comes out, it gets oxygenated and it goes back into the heart to make sure the heart still stays working in its normal way.
Oh, right. So, of course, you don't need artificial lungs, because the job of the lungs is actually to oxygenate the blood. So it's just the blood you need to oxygenate. So you don't need tubes going into the lungs, like I thought. It's actually just an IV with blood and then moving the blood through the body.
Yeah, essentially the blood comes out. The machine's job is to remove the carbon dioxide, put in the oxygen, which is, I mean, like, you know, 30 years ago you wouldn't say this, but it is a fairly simple task.
Right, okay.
It's a reasonably straightforward idea. And then the blood goes back in. So it really is just remarkable. And there's all sorts of complications. You have to keep it at the right temperature, the right pH, all of these things, you know. But overarchingly, it's a kind of a simple idea, which people have been able to do now. It's amazing. I just think it's amazing.
Very good. Shane, our second story has to do with snakes.
Yeah. Snakes can go for weeks, if not months, without eating dinner, which is incredible. I don't know about you, but if I miss one meal, I'm an antichrist. And everyone around me knows. But
do you have emergency snacks in your car in case you get stuck in traffic?
I do.
Yeah,
I absolutely do. And whenever I travel, I always fill my backpack with snacks. So in case I arrive to some foreign hotel. And
I can't imagine you being cranky. I can't imagine you being like in a bad mood.
You should ask my wife.
Oh, it's okay. Right. Let's move on. Yeah. We're talking about snakes.
We are, absolutely. So as I was saying, they can go for ages without eating. And it wasn't quite known how they're able to do this, like, because most animals will just keep hunting until they eat, and they just keep going cycle to cycle. And then, but the snake is able to go into this low power mode for quite a long time before it catches its next meal. And this study has looked at a genetic reason for this. So it's a study that looked at 112 species of reptile, mainly snakes, and they found that the particular gene that most vertebrates have for producing the hormone that makes us hungry, called ghrelin. Snakes don't have the right gene to do that. The gene is either being completely removed or warped to the point that it's not able to produce the hormone.
Nice.
So the snake just doesn't have the same driver that you and I and the dog would have to go and look for dinner.
Oh, wow. So a snake never knows if it's hungry or not.
Well, this actually, as I read the story and read the paper, I wondered, well, how do they know to eat then? They must have some drivers. And so the paper does explain that while this hormone is really important, it's not the only thing that will drive your appetite. Because when we first discovered the hormone in mammals about 30 years ago, scientists thought, well, maybe we could use that knowledge to treat obesity. But unfortunately, they found that it was a cocktail of hormones that was responsible for hunger, which I guess makes sense, right? Because if for one reason or another, we had a genetic abnormality and that meant we weren't able to be hungry, you die pretty quickly as an animal. So you'd need multiple ways to kind of trigger you to go and eat your dinner. So the snake doesn't have the main one. And not only that, it doesn't have the particular enzyme that kind of causes the hormone to do its work. So it has two things missing that you and I and other species have to drive us toward dinner. So not only does it not get hungry, it's able to kind of use its fat reserves in a way that allows it be in kind of low power mode for such a long time and to kind of just wait it out until the next poor unfortunate little furry thing crawls in front of it.
Very good. Our third story, Laura, has to do with light pollution.
It does, yeah. So we've known for many years that light pollution is a problem for people's diurnal shift. So we produce melatonin, as do lots of other animals, so birds, animals that live in urban environments. And melatonin levels have been changing based on artificial light. So light that comes from the street, LED lights. But it's never really been seen in a marine environment. And what these researchers in Miami have just published in the Science of the Total Environment, which is the name of the journal, is that they did research on two types of sharks that lived in Miami. So one type called the nurse shark that lived very close to the coast, and another type called the black tip shark, which is able to move further away from the coast. So in theory, be less affected by light pollution. And what they did was they went out and they actually captured these sharks, took out blood and then re-released the sharks. And they looked to see the melatonin levels. And what they found was that the nurse sharks, the ones who are more tied to the shore are quite badly affected by the LEDs and by the false artificial light. And it's changing their diurnal patterns and their melatonin levels. And it's kind of remarkable because sharks have been around for, 400 million years or something. So in that time, they've survived however many extinctions and biodiversity changes and climate shifts and all these things. And they've been amazingly robust in terms of surviving. And now here comes people, as always, with their artificial light. And we are again changing this age-old species for the worse, presumably. So it's a shame and another problem with the human environment.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, you know, when we look at things like the Industrial Revolution and, you know, its effects on the famous illustration of how evolution works is the moths that change color. That, you know, that pre-industrial revolution, you had these white moths and then loads of soot came along and the white moths were easier to spot. And so the ones that were darker lived longer. And so the species over time ended up being a much darker moth. And then as that cleaned up, it went back to the ones that were surviving were the ones that didn't stand out against white bark or whatever. And so the idea is that, you know, in a short space of time, the Industrial Revolution wasn't a very long time, but because moths' life cycle is quite short, you can see this evolution happening quite quickly. With sharks, you know, do we know that, you know, giving them a nighttime and a daytime that is artificial is really going to have that much effect on them? What is the evidence that this is a bad thing?
Yeah, look, I mean, I suppose that the research doesn't go into that. They don't look at the sort of potential for the positive evolutionary consequences of this, as it were. And as you said, with something like a shark, which tends to live for years, and some sharks for decades, and some sharks like the Greenland shark for centuries, it isn't as easy to study as it would be with a short-lived species like the moth, or with a much shorter reproduction time. So they don't look into that. But that said, you can't assume it's going to be a good thing.
No.
Yes, there might be some that are more adapted to this change in melatonin and therefore they are the ones that survive. But it's also, you know, it's hard to change animals that are that age old. Only small shifts can sometimes have catastrophic consequences for species that can't reproduce as fast as, for instance, insects. So I don't know is the answer, but I can't imagine this being a good thing.
Yeah. And to be honest, if it gives them worse sleep, like I'm a cranky ass person, but what you don't want is like, yeah, I don't get a lot of sleep. I'm not well. You don't want a cranky ass shark. That's what you don't want.
Definitely not.
All right. Our fourth story, Shane, make this interesting, has to do with seagrass.
Yeah, absolutely. So this week we have seen along the East Coast, the sea come over the wall. And so the DART stations around South County Dublin and I'm sure North County Dublin the same have been inundated by the sea. And this is a phenomenon that we see more frequently because of a warming climate. And we hear a lot about nature-based solutions for climate change, as well as, or instead of, engineering-based solutions like building a wall. And people in Humber, the Humber estuary in New Yorkshire and Lincolnshire, have been showing the benefits of planting seagrass. Not just kind of adding a new species in, but in fact, restoring something that was once there. So once upon a time, there was well over 1,000 acres of this particular species of seagrass in the Humber estuary. The Humber estuary, like much of the east coast of England, is very kind of a low sloping seashore. So it looks quite like Clontarf, you know, there are parts of Wexford. There isn't a big cliff. So the sea is able to come in rather easily. And so they found that if you plant in the grass, you're able to sort of arrest the worst of the damage from major storms. But beyond that, you're also able to increase biodiversity of various animals and plants that might live there. And on top of that, you're creating a massive carbon storage sink. So incredibly, seagrass is 35 times faster than your average tropical rainforest at absorbing carbon. So it does a very good job at absorbing carbon, offering homes for plants and animals, but also, and perhaps from a human-centric point of view, the most important thing, it's able to stop the worst of these big storms kind of battering the shore and eroding sandbanks and causing damage then to life and limb.
Is it really? Like, I don't understand how seagrass would stop the massive sort of coastal activity we've seen this week.
Well, it on its own may not do everything, but it's an incredibly important aspect of it. So what it will do is, it's like a shock absorber, yeah. Right? So even though we see the top of the water being angry, of course, there's a lot of churn that's going on underneath it. And as storms come in and sort of do their damage, what they're doing is they're scraping away and eroding the subsoil or the sand that's there. And if there's nothing to bind it and hold it together, it's very easy for it to quite literally get washed out to sea. So by clumping things together with grasses, much like you see on the land, you're able to offer far more structural stability to the seabed so that the storm doesn't come in and just kind of scoop out an entire beach in one go. And similarly, as the storm comes in, the interaction or the roughness of the seabed is able to kind of dampen to some extent the worst excesses of the dangerous waves. It doesn't prevent it, okay. but it helps.
Dr. Shane Bergen, Dr. Laura Dungan, thank you very much. Yes, welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. Now, close your eyes and picture an apple. In your mind's eye, I want you to see a vivid picture of an apple. You have that? Well, I don't, because I suffer from, well, I don't know if suffer is the right word, but I have, apparently, aphantasia. No image, no picture. When I do that, I see nothing. So today on the programme, we're going to be talking about aphantasia and the fascinating way some brains don't visualise. We're joined by the man who helped name the term, Professor Adam Zeman, whose latest book, The Shape of Things Unseen, explores the strange and surprising science of the imagination. Welcome to the programme, Adam. So I've been using this term that you coined for many years. So that's kind of cool to be the person who came up with the name. Explain it to me, because I think I have aphantasia. When people, like that experiment of saying, imagine an apple with your eyes closed, like Marais, my producer, says she can actually see it very clearly. Which is more common, to have it or not have it?
So it's more common to have it, at least to some degree. So most people, if they try to visualize an apple or their best friend or their favorite place, have an experience that is somewhat visual. It's a bit like seeing, but there's a very wide spectrum. So there are people who say that the experience is really just like seeing, that their visualization is as vivid as if they really were looking at the apple.
Wow.
For most of us, that's not the case. There is a somewhat visual experience, but the image is a little less distinct, a little less vivid than it would be if we were actually looking at the apple. And then for about 4% of people, there is no image at all.
I am struggling. I'm thinking of like a seagull. I'm struggling in my head to put anything on paper with my eyes closed. I cannot see a seagull.
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, I think it can be difficult if you put people on the spot. People sometimes find it hard to be confident about these rather elusive aspects of their experience. So maybe you should give yourself a little time and just see if you can.
I've never been able to do it.
Catch yourself imaging.
Yeah. No, I've never been able to do it. I've never been able to visualize in that way because there's been times in my life where I've tried to conjure up because I've enjoyed them and it's like goo. It just doesn't happen.
Right. So had you recognized that was a little unusual?
No. When I did radio, the first couple of years at a radio, I came across synesthesia as a thing. Mm-hmm. The idea that people can experience senses that overlap in a way. So people might taste color or something. And when we had it on the radio program, the amount of people went, what? I thought everyone had that. It was incredible. And that's what the great power of radio, right? Is to help people understand that actually their abnormality is completely normal. But sometimes people don't even realize that they're abnormal. I didn't realize this wasn't how everyone experienced the world. So there you go.
Okay.
And so what does this say about my brain versus someone else's brain? I mean, is it just a quirk or are there other, I wouldn't say symptoms, but other things that we associate with aphantasia?
Yeah, no, I mean, so I would say that it is a quirk rather than a disorder.
Yeah.
So I think it's an intriguing variation in experience rather than an abnormality. But there does seem to be a pattern of associations. So people with aphantasia on the whole, and
they're very handsome.
They're exceptions to the rule. People with aphantasia on the whole have a somewhat thinner autobiographical memory than those with imagery, so find it a little more difficult to relive experiences from the past, give slightly less rich descriptions of past events. I don't know whether that's true for you.
I'm laughing because I give very rich descriptions of other people's past because I think I've lived them. There's a story about Coolio cutting me off at a party in LA. to go to the toilet. And I told this story for many years until my friend said, that wasn't you, that was me. And I lost a very cool story that I had. Well, but I genuinely thought it was me.
That's really interesting, because sometimes people who have aphantasia say that thinking about their own past is rather like thinking about somebody else's past.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel.
Precisely, because it's difficult to relive in the way that many of us can. So that's one association. Another association, and each of these associations occurs only in a subset of people with aphantasia, but some people find it difficult to recognize faces. I don't know whether that's true for you.
I do struggle, but I think that's just... I meet a lot of people who they go, oh, I know you from the TV. And so it's easier for them. So in comparison, obviously not a lot of people, but, you know, they might. And so by comparison, I think they've got a jump on me. So I feel like I recognize nobody, and I feel like, you know, in comparison, it's just a way. And a lot of the time then they go, oh, no, actually, I think you bumped into my car 10 years ago. Isn't it to do with the TV?
Doesn't sound as if you're too bad. And this probably isn't true of you, but aphantasia seems to nudge people in the direction of working in STEM subjects. So it seems to predispose people to think in somewhat more abstract ways than others. So mathematics, IT, science, common among...
Started out in IT. You're reading my tea leaves here, Adam. What else? What are my lotto numbers? This is incredible.
Well, so another feature that we discovered after we'd identified the absence of visual imagery was that quite often people with aphantasia lack imagery in other senses too. So I don't know how much of a mind's ear you have or a mind's fingertip. Can you hear thunder or hear the sound of a siren in your mind's ear?
I can. Yeah, I think I can imagine that. I like music, so I think sound is not.
So
we're kind of weirdly making this all about me, and that is is that something that people who have aphantasia do?
No.
I don't want to make this all about me, but you're finding these.
I'm always interested to talk to people.
No, and you know what? It's not your fault. It's my fault. It's very clearly my fault. So, the people that you speak to with aphantasia, these are sort of correlations, essentially. There's nothing that you've seen, or there probably isn't enough evidence to suggest that we can see anything in the brain that's different, right?
So there are interesting differences in the brain.
Oh, wow.
I began on this path because I met a patient who had lost the ability to visualize. And we did a brain imaging study in him, which had interesting results. So he was, when he looked at faces, famous faces, faces he knew, his brain activated completely normally, just as yours or mine would.
Yeah.
But when he tried to visualize them, he failed to activate visual regions in the brain, which most of us do activate when we visualize. So probably the reason that when we imagine an apple, we get an experience that's a bit visual. The reason is that we actually activate visual parts of the brain. And this patient, MX, as we called him, was unable to do that. So that was an interesting correlate, if you like, for the change in his experience. Now, people have now looked at folk with lifelong aphantasia, which is much more common than losing it. So the cases in which people have lost imagery are relatively rare. It's much more common to lack it throughout your life. And people who lack it throughout their life seem to have some differences in the connectivity of the brain. So one finding early on was that if you just ask someone to lie in a scanner and chill, in people with very vivid imagery, you find stronger connections between regions at the front of the brain, which, if you like, have to do with thinking, and regions at the back of the brain that have to do with vision, than you do in people with aphantasia. So one can see how thought might translate itself more readily, more naturally into imagery in people with vivid imagery, people with aphantasia, than in people who lack it with aphantasia. And more recent work is kind of bearing out that general idea that the difference here may relate to the connectivity of long-range connectivity within the brain.
Right. God, it's kind of funny. Like, you know, one's own experience of reality is so subjective that, you can never really step inside 100% inside someone else's brain, obviously. So all you get to work on are descriptions of what we see. But if you actually were to go inside my body and see what I saw, it might horrify you.
I think there are differences. So some people are very skeptical about this and say, you know, how is it possible to compare your own experience with someone else's or to compare two people's experience? And I think to be confident that there are real differences, you do have to show that there are some measurable differences as well as differences in people's experience reported subjectively. The brain imaging work is one such example of an objective difference there, but there are others. So one nice experiment looked at the changes in the size of the pupil. So if somebody with imagery imagines looking at the sun, their pupils constrict. And if they imagine looking into a dark room, their pupils dilate.
No. Those
differences are not present in people with aphantasia.
Is that a good quality study?
That was a good study.
Okay,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
A lot of, over 20 years, there's a lot of pop sci that goes out there, you know, and you're thinking, is that really true? That's really interesting. Some people can imagine so vividly that their pupils dilate when they think of the sun.
Or constrict when they think of the sun. Yeah,
oh, sorry, that's constrict.
Right.
Wow.
That's right. Yeah. So I quite agree. You need to sort of triangulate, don't you, between people's reports and things you can measure both in their behavior and in their bodies.
Yeah, very cool. What about hyperphantasia then? The opposite of me, where someone not only can picture something, but they picture it very, very vividly. Anything how common is that? And
so it seems to be somewhat common in aphantasia. So aphantasia probably occurs in about 4% of the population. Hyperphantasia occurs in getting on for 10%.
Wow.
And people with aphantasia say that they, for example, sometimes confuse what they've imagined with what's really happened. So it can be because of the vividness of their imagination, it can be difficult for them to tell apart remembered events from imagined ones.
Wow. The idea that I could remember something so vividly that if I close my eyes, I could replay it. Like, God, there's so many moments of my life, sunsets and moments I cherish, they're just gone. They're like they like pass like grains of sand through my fingers. The idea that I would be able to recall them in vivid imagery, that'd be amazing.
Yeah. I remember one lady with hyperphantasia saying that she'd had a kind of traumatic experience from an imagined event.
Wow. Yeah, because if you mix hyperphantasia with intrusive thoughts, that is, that could be potentially. Potentially dangerous. Is there research looking at schizophrenia and hyperphantasia? Or, because if you are someone who suffers from delusions and they're very vivid to you.
I think this research is at a fairly early stage, but there is some evidence linking vivid imagery with PTSD.
Right.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, makes sense.
And there's a little bit of evidence that vivid imagery is a risk factor for psychosis, for schizophrenia, for hallucinations in Parkinson's disease. I think more is required to be confident about that. But it would make sense, wouldn't it, if the lacking imagery should really protect you from conditions in which imagery sort of breaks loose and becomes intrusive and troublesome, and vivid imagery you would predict would be a risk factor.
For sure. Let's talk then about the ability to change this. I mean, has anyone ever managed to train themselves to visualize, sort of reverse aphantasia?
Yeah, so it seems to be hard. So quite a number of people with aphantasia have told me that they've tried. They've followed various sort of regimes of mental exercise to try to cultivate their imagery, and generally they haven't succeeded. So I think there probably is some kind of biological barrier. But there is, of course, the question of whether they really want to. And we had a conference back in 2019 for people with aphantasia and hyperphantasia, and there was quite a long, interesting discussion amongst the folk with aphantasia about whether they would like to be given imagery. And the consensus in the end was that they would, but just for a day. So they'd like to know what it was like, but they were actually perfectly happy the way they were.
And finally, what about memory? Do memories have any effect on aphantasia or vice versa?
So I would say
the reason I ask is that the memory experts, the people who can remember things for numbers or things, lists of objects that go on forever, they often create a memory palace with their mind. They walk through the door and they say, I put, my keys on a table that's red. And they basically can memorize, long, difficult things because they create this vivid memory in their mind. I can do that, but I can't visualize it. So I'm wondering, are those two things different?
Well, that's a really, really very interesting question, which I think goes quite deep. I mean, the first thing I'd say is that memory is less affected by aphantasia than you might expect. Hmm. So many people, when they first hear of it, say, but how can they remember at all?
And
clearly folk with aphantasia do remember pretty well. as we were discussing, what is called autobiographical memory seems to be a bit less rich in aphantasia. So people have a less of an ability to sort of travel in time to re-experience events from the past.
Yeah.
But there does seem to be a distinction between what is called spatial imagery and object imagery. And what's lacking in aphantasia is object imagery. So if you ask people with aphantasia, for example, to count the number of windows in their apartment, you know, without leaving their chair, they can do that. And when you ask them how, they say, well, I've got a kind of understanding, a sense of where things are, a sort of map in my mind.
Mm.
And so what I suspect is happening when you're using that kind of memory palace is that you're generating that sort of map. And that kind of imagery, that form of spatial imagery, seems to be preserved and possibly even boosted in aphantasia. So yeah, that's a very interesting question.
Fantastic. Well, the book is called The Shape of Things Unseen, A New Science of Imagination. It's just out on paperback. Professor Adam Zeman, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
All right, it's time to look back at some of your comments from last week's episode. John H. emailed us. He said, hi, Jonathan. As a confirmed skeptic of dark matter, are you one too, or are you just recognizing that I am one, John? He says, I thought I would share this article that came through my Google feed. I'm no expert, just a science geek that reads this stuff, trying to understand it and make sense of the world. Love the show. I had a very quick look at it. It is beyond my pay grade. And that is the problem with this, which I'll address in the next piece. My distrust of the phenomenon of dark energy and dark matter comes only from ignorance. I want to be very clear about that. To me, it is, I am like looking at tea leaves, or, you know, the way the dogs howl at night. That it's a hunch. It's a total hunch, my thing about dark energy. And it's not, and almost every researcher in the field would say, yeah, you just don't understand. So just want to be very clear. But I have to say, I tried to read through. I find it quite difficult sometimes to understand. But thank you very much for sending it on. John sent in a thing about the observed effects of an exploding primordial black hole that might theoretically be able to answer some of the black, the dark matter, dark energy stuff without requiring all of the stuff around the universe that we said is there. But it segues quite nicely into this next piece, which is from Oren. Oren says, I just wanted to write to say it's great to hear someone else out there questioning the idea of dark energy and dark matter, at least in the quantities that are posited, which is like, you know, it makes up almost all of the energy in our universe. Consequently, he says, I was particularly interested in your interview with Professor Brian Schmidt, where an oft-repeated proof of dark matter was referenced, that the rate of the universe is expanding as it is increasing rather than reducing, so it should be expected as the energy from the Big Bang dissipates and the action of other forces such as gravity act upon matter. As a non-scientist and fellow dark matter skeptic, so my worry is that I have started this sort of legion of skeptics who have no experience in science, research, or anything. That is the opposite of what I'm trying to do as a research, as a science program, right? I'm supposed to be like increasing trust and faith in science. But he says, as a fellow dark matter skeptic, I always wonder why we're so sure that the universe should have reached this slowdown point. For instance, surely we don't unquestionably know what the universe is expanding into or what is beyond the observable universe. So how are we certain about any effects from there? I struggle with that, right? I really struggle with how we can really understand our universe when we talk about the universe, but not really the universe, only the observable universe. We don't know what happened beyond the observable universe. So then how can we talk about the universe? Do you know what I mean? If when we talk to researchers, when they say the universe, they don't mean the universe. They mean the observable universe, because what's the point in talking about the other stuff? But actually, it's kind of really important to know if the observable universe is the whole universe or if it's different out there. And how do we get our physics when it's unobservable? Anyway, it's a Kruger-Dunning thing. That's what I think it is. I'm too uninformed to know the difficulties and understand the science here. And we should probably just get this to bed, and I should probably be handheld through this, Marais. We should probably just get someone to do the 2 + 2 = 4 on a page and explain it for me. He says, I've also heard that Hubble tension referenced as something that points towards the need for dark energy or matter, but does it not just highlight that we currently don't have the correct maths or observational tools yet? See, this is it. Everyone I speak to says, we do have the tools to say this is everything as our best shot. As far as we understand, this is what's going on. And there's lots of evidence to suggest there is dark matter and dark energy. And I think it's probably my oversimplification of the matter that's given all these skeptics hope that maybe there's something else going on. But I don't know. Oren says, imagine any other branch of science gathering knowingly incomplete data. Have you met archaeologists? Then based on this, confidently deciding what the answer should be and then making up an equation that finds this answer, but only if a vast quantity of something completely undetectable is included. There probably are some energy and matter that we can call dark something, but I can't understand this unquestioning belief that 95% of the universe is made up of undetectable things instead of the possibility that our equations or observations are a bit off. That's kind of where I am. But as I say, I don't know what I'm talking about, Oren. That's the problem. But yeah, it doesn't make sense to me. And who knows? Maybe we'll figure out the maths are wrong, or maybe they'll explain. But right now, I'm not sure about dark matter. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, who's producing, Rory Galvin, Hugh Keenan on podcasts, and Hugo da Silva on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae. Proudly supported by Research Ireland. Sunday from midday. News Talk. Conversation that counts.
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.